Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us at the Free Library of Philadelphia at Home. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Before we begin tonight's presentation, I wanted to point out a couple of useful features on your screen. You'll see there's a button below that suggests that you buy a copy of our guest's new book, Afro-Pessimism. The button links to the website of the Joseph Fox Bookshop, our bookseller for more than 20 years. I know they will be happy to send a copy to you anywhere in the country. On screen, you'll also see the Ask a Question link, which you can use to ask a question, suggest a topic, or upvote a question by using the arrows in the left margin. It's now my honor to introduce our guest, Chair of African American Studies and Professor in the Culture and Theory Doctoral Program at the University of California, Irvine, Frank B. Wilderson III, spent more than 5 years in South Africa, where he was elected to the African National Congress during the country's transformation after apartheid. His books include Incognito, A Memoir of Exile and Apartheid, and Red, White, and Black, Cinema and the Structure of U.S. Antagonisms. His writing has been honored with the Zora Neale Hurston Richard Wright Legacy Award for Creative Nonfiction and an NEA Literature Fellowship. In his new book, Afro-Pessimism, memoir and philosophy flow through and from one another as Wilderson elucidates an Afro-pessimist worldview with examples from his own life, which in turn inform philosophy. Frank, the screen is all yours.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. Am I coming through okay?
Loud and clear.
All right, very good. Well, this is, I think, the third time that I've done something like this. It seems new every time. I want to thank everyone. Normally, I would thank everyone for coming out tonight and sharing their evening with me in the auditorium of the Free Library of Philadelphia. But I guess you've come out in your homes and we're together like this. Perhaps as horrible as this is, perhaps there are more of us in this kind of situation than there would have been, say, in an auditorium. I don't know. Anyway, it's not worth the extra numbers, and I hope everyone is safe and healthy. I'm going to share with you an episode from my book. And those of you who have seen the book or read some of my other work or are somewhat familiar with Afro-pessimism know that in this particular book, there are two trains running and they kind of meld together, as I told John Williams of the New York Times. One train is the train of critical theory, which seeks to explain the structure of Black suffering as something that cannot be reconciled with the structure of suffering of subalterns, such as oppressed women who are not Black, the working class, and post-colonial subjects. So that is the high theory intervention that we have made in the past, say, 10, 15 years. However, I do want to reiterate that that intervention has been made for at least 200 years in a kind of sublimated way in the poems, stories, and music of Black people. What we have done is to shown its first principles and its constituent elements with respect to critical theory. So that's one part of the book. And I know that there are probably a lot of questions from people like high school and college debaters who use these high theory and these levels of abstraction in their debate. A lot of questions perhaps from college students and especially graduate students doing critical theory and Marxism or psychoanalysis, as well as professors. But the general public may not have an idea of what's at stake with respect to the Afro-pessimist intervention. So I'm not going to, if I were to explicate that, I would be taking up all the time that I have to share a story with you, as well as the time that you want to ask questions. So I really can't go into that. What I would hope that you would do, I hope that you would buy this book and then look at, as you read, if you're not familiar with Afro-pessimism, note the people who have been quoted in this. And because the footnotes are kind of embedded, in other words, it's a trade book as opposed to a critical theory university press book. So because these footnotes have been embedded, which you'll find them in the back of the book. I don't know if I can show you this, but not with numbers, but with bold letters of words from various parts in the body of the text itself. So for example, if you're reading along and you see the phrase libidinal economy inside of a story, and it kind of acts as a speed bump for you because you don't know what libidinal economy is, then you just simply turn to the back of the book and you'll find libidinal economy in bold, and there will be a definition of it from my friend and colleague Jared Sexton. Okay, so that's how these footnotes are embedded. They're not numbered, but they will help. I want to say before I begin this vignette, give a kind of schematic overview of what the stakes are. And for that, I need a stage prop. One second. This is Orlando Patterson's Slavery and Social Death. And to my mind, this is a book that is as momentous to the thinking about captivity and slavery as Karl Marx's Das Kapital Volume 1 was to the thinking of the relational dynamic of political economy in 1869. And there's a place in Slavery and Social Death in which he has the following sentence. He says, the problem in a slaveholding society, however, was that it was usually necessary to introduce new persons to the status of slaves because the former slaves either died out or were manumitted. Okay, then he goes on. The worker who is fired remains a worker to be hired elsewhere. So in other words, there's no paradigmatic shift in getting fired. You're still in the same position of worker. You're just surplus labor, unemployed, but you could become employed labor later on. But the slave who was freed was no longer a slave. Thus, it was necessary continually to repeat the original violent act of transforming free man into slave. Did you get that? It was important to repeat. I'll read it again. Thus, it was necessary continually to repeat the original violent act of transforming free man into slave. And so that's one of the schematic or paradigmatic nodal points that I found to be, for me, were kind of an aha moment. In other words, one of the problems that Afro-pessimism deals with is the fact that the structure and the ritualistic performance of anti-Black violence cannot be reconciled with the structure and the ritualistic performance of, say, anti-immigrant violence or anti-Native American violence. There's a way in which there's something different going on here. Okay, so the next two sentences, he goes, the act of violence constitutes the prehistory of all stratified societies. The act of violence constitutes the prehistory of all stratified societies. Well, any Marxist economist will understand what that means. What it means is that 300 years ago, we did not have a relational dynamic of capitalism. So there were no workers and there were no capitalists. In order to produce a new paradigm that will saturate the entire globe, you need an ocean of violence to transform peasantry into proletariat. And that ocean of violence is called the prehistory of the paradigm. All right. But then he says, the act of violence, I'll read it again. The act of violence constitutes the prehistory of all stratified societies, but it determines both the prehistory and the concurrent history of slavery. Now, for a critical theorist, that is one of those golden moments of terror and trauma. Because what it says is that inside the structure of capitalism, Once people have inculcated their roles in their unconscious as workers, then you actually do not want the gratuitous nature of the violence that produced the capitalist system to continue on. You want to rule those people through hegemony. You want them to be disciplined. You only want the violence that created capitalism to rear its head again when there's resistance, strikes, the Cuban Revolution, for example. But he's saying that with slavery, the prehistory that constitutes the paradigm is also the concurrent history of the lived experience of the paradigm. That's pretty heavy, because what it means is that the slave lives in a soup of irrational, or I would say nonsensical, violence that cannot be reconciled with the violence of the working class, because the violence of the slave doesn't transform itself into hegemony when the slave acquiesces to his, her, or their position. All right, so that's what's at stake for me in the Afro-Pessimist Project. Let me shift now to the other mode of expression, still the English language, but with a different kind of vernacular, and that's a story. And this story resonates with what I just said, even though I'm going to only read you about 6 pages, and it may not be clear. But if you've read the chapter, Hattie McDaniel is Dead, which starts on page 55, then you'll understand what I'm saying. So let me begin. This is chapter 3, a few pages that begin on page 55. And for those of you who have asked where I'm going to start, that's where I'm starting. But at a certain point in time, because I'm only going to read 6 pages, I'm going to jump towards the middle and read a few paragraphs from that. So you won't be able to follow me after a certain point, but I hope that's okay. What do you need to know if you have not read the book? And what I think, one thing I want to say before I start is I'm really thankful to Liveright Norton for producing this really beautiful, beautifully constructed book. The book came on sale on April 7th, and we're in the first printing of the book. And so what Bob Weil and Gabe Kachuk and Peter Miller and all the folks at Liveright, W.W. Norton did for me and for this book is they made really heavy, literally heavy paper on this first printing. So if you buy the first printing, you're going to have a book that is very special in terms of its material value. And the second printing will be valuable as well, but it won't have the heavy paper. All right. Hattie McDaniel is Dead. This is the years 1976 to 1980. I am 20 to 24. So it's going to kind of jump around a bit in that particular time period, 76 to 1980. And the city is, for the most part, Minneapolis, Minnesota. This is a story I've never told before. Not to my brother or to my sisters. Not even to the women I've partnered with and married. Nearly 40 years came and went before I could bring myself to say what happened to Stella, her daughter Malaika, and me. To go into it, I've always thought, would only cause embarrassment for me, a sudden need to be elsewhere, which is the natural response to a confession. Even now, I'll admit, the story makes me squirm, living with the shame of wanting out when I thought I could die. I believe that when it was time for the get down, I would face the man like Black Liberation Army soldier Asada Shakur faced the man on the New Jersey Turnpike when the state troopers shot her in the chest. That I would get busy like Jonathan P. Jackson got busy at the courthouse in Marin, California. If the stakes ever became high enough, if the revolution required my sacrifice, I would simply tap a secret reservoir of courage that had been accumulating inside of me from the age of 12 when I read Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice. And when my junior high and high school teachers were the doppelgangers of the defendants in the political trials like the Chicago 8 and the Panther 21. Stella happened to be one of those doubles. We were together almost 10 years, though we were never married. She was 38 when we met. I was 22. I thought it all started when I met Stella at the end of March 1968, just a week after Dartmouth College sent me home for leading Black students in a campaign in solidarity with the people who made the food and cleaned the toilets and lived outside of town. Apparently, some frat boys had complained to the administration that the people from the Appalachian Trail had facial and other deformities brought on by what some Dartmouth fraternity brothers called hillbilly inbreeding. Seeing those people from the Appalachian Trail eating in the same room with them gave them indigestion, the letter claimed. The administration responded by ruling that the service workers in Thayer Dining Hall and the buildings and ground workers must, from that moment on, eat during off-peak hours and only in antechambers of the dining room that would be set aside for them and them alone. This was a fascist decree, I argued, and we had to take action. But many others pointed out that the workers who came from nearby backwater towns like Lebanon, New Hampshire, and many two-store and one-saloon towns skirting the mountains flew the Confederate flag in some of the bars and yelled, "Nigger!" from speeding pickups when they drove past us. Once there were three of us lost in the countryside in a time when not even Dick Tracy had GPS. We drove past low-roofed houses ranged along a forest road like matchsticks spilled on the floor. Every fourth or fifth car was a rusted carcass with cinderblock wheels. I was startled by the lack of hatred in the eyes of the children who stared at us as we drove by. When I turned in my seat and looked back at them, they were still staring, as though waiting for God to help them name what they had just seen. In the end, the Afro-American Society at Dartmouth College voted to launch a civil disobedience campaign aimed at forcing the administration to rescind its decree. During the campaign, I was arrested and jailed. A dean waited for me outside the Hanover, New Hampshire courthouse. He handed me a 2-page single-spaced charge sheet. I told him the town of Hanover had dropped all the charges. He implored me to read the letter. "Your troubles with the town have just ended," he said, "but your troubles with Dartmouth College have just begun." Two years prior, just before I turned 20, the FBI had tracked me to Trinidad. Like most intelligence files, by the time they are declassified, mine is riddled with redactions like sprigs of buckshot etched on the flank of a deer. The name of the agent who tailed me to Trinidad in the winter of 1976, the winter of my sophomore year at Dartmouth College, has been redacted. Nor did he or she seem interested in what the not quite 20-year-old young man he or she shadowed was studying. At the University of the West Indies, he studied Caribbean theater. He did field research on Rada, a major family of Loa, or spirits, in Trinidad's incarnation of the West African religion, Vudan. His third course was an independent study he designed himself, a 50-page thesis paper he wrote on his experiences as a participant researcher of the Communist Party in Trinidad. The FBI file referenced none of this. The report went like this. During his stay in Trinidad, Wilderson was in contact with a member of the Trinidad and Tobago Puerto Rican Solidarity Committee, and he promised that individual he would attempt to make contacts in the United States for that organization to obtain literature for it and to attempt to produce financial aid. To procure financial aid. Wilderson allegedly claimed to be a member of an unspecified revolutionary group in the United States. He was born April 11th, 1956 in the United States, is a student at Dartmouth College, possesses U.S. passport number F2316717, and his mailing address is Hinman Box 3983, Dartmouth College, Hanover, New Hampshire, 03755. This report was sent from Leggett, it's capital L-A-G-A-T, from Leggett Caracas, the legal attaché in Venezuela, to Clarence M. Kelly, J. Edgar Hoover's successor as director of the FBI. According to official propaganda, the FBI legal attaché works with the law enforcement and security agencies in their host country to coordinate investigations of interest to both countries. The role of legal attachés is primarily one of coordination, as they do not conduct foreign intelligence gathering or counterintelligence investigations, end quote. No explanation is given as to why the legate for the FBI in Venezuela was running an asset in Trinidad to spy on an American student, or what the nature of the joint operation between the U.S. and the host country, Trinidad or Venezuela, might be. The report begins, "This confidential source abroad mentioned in the memorandum is," the redaction is nearly two lines long. In other words, more than a name is being withheld. It continues, "Blank requested to be informed if Wilderson has come to the attention in the past for political extremist activities in the United States," end quote. Then, "The Bureau and the Boston office are requested to advise if Wilderson has come to prior attention in connection with security activities." This, however, is not the story I had never been able to tell. That story I'm going to tell you now, but this FBI report complicates that story. It corrupts the causal links that had helped me make sense of the violence that Stella and I were subjected to 4 years after I returned from Trinidad in 1980, 2 years after Dartmouth College in 1978 had kicked me out for leading a civil disobedience campaign on behalf of workers who were white and, to our Black and lonely student minds, unrepentant racists. The FBI file came in the middle of writing this chapter. It corrupted the causal logic of the events that make my hand quiver as I scratch these words with my pen. Before the file arrived, I thought that at last I can chart a point-to-point pilgrim's progress of the chain of events that drove Stella and me and Malaika, her 11-year-old daughter, from our home. Events that left us no alternative but to send Malaika away to live with relatives for her own safety. Events that drove Stella and me from the state of Minnesota when we ran out of friends and sanctuaries. The FBI file came when I was finally steadfast in my conviction that what happened to us had to do with Stella's past. Not hers and mine, but hers alone. I even blamed the break-in at my studio apartment by two white men who wanted nothing of value as collateral heat from Stella's lawsuit against the government. I was not yet driving a cab at that point. That would start when I moved in with Stella. I still worked as a waiter at Williams Cafe in uptown Minneapolis, but the restaurant was slow one night and I was sent home early. My studio was on the ground floor of an old brownstone six blocks from Lake of the Isles. The key worked, but the door to my studio was chained from the inside. How could I have done that? I thought, in self-rebuke. It took a moment for me to realize that in point of fact, I could not have done that. Someone else did that. That someone was inside. I sprinted down the hall. I burst out the front door and dashed to where I could see my apartment window. The alley light lit them in silhouette. One leg curled out the window of my studio, then his torso, then the other leg. He stumbled and almost fell before he ran. But the other one rolled out with the grace of a pole vaulter clearing the bar. His long hair flounced up and down in the low yellow light. Like a fool, I chased them halfway down the alley. Like an even bigger fool, I called the cops. When the police arrived, even with my Murphy bed close into the wall, there was little space left with one large cot by the sink and stove and me and his partner in the middle of the room. "You have this wad of cash on you, or you left it here when you went to work," the one by the sink said to me, pointing to the money in the dish drainer, tip money that I carelessly left by the sink until I could go to the bank. I told him I had left it there. "Did you leave this Miranda camera here when you went to the restaurant?" I nodded. The cop by the sink was counting. 80, 85, 90, $95 in cash. A camera worth what? 2 C-notes? $300 worth of stuff just left here? "You say someone, 2 people, I corrected him. "You say 2 people climbed in, chained the door from the inside, and then, what, play bridge? Had a cup of coffee? You see how it looks from where we stand." "I have a right to privacy. That's what they stole." They looked at me as though I had said, "I have a right to shingles." My books had been taken from my bookshelf and arranged on the floor in neat, orderly rows. The case to my typewriter was open, and pages from a novel I was writing were spread on the desk. "Whoever did this," I said, "knew my schedule. They thought they had time." "Time for what?" "You won't know unless you investigate." The cop by the sink nodded. "Investigate. Gotcha." Then he stooped and picked up 2 books from the floor and said, "Eye of Stone, The Killings at Kent State, How Murder Went Unpunished, Karl Marx, The Communist Manifesto." He placed both books back neatly on the floor. "What are you doing reading this stuff for?" Not surprisingly, I soon moved in with Stella and Malaika and a gun in the closet that we didn't know how to use. Thank you.
Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Thank you so much for that reading. Before we move into some of the audience questions, I wanted to sort of circle and allow you to wind things together again by asking you, would you talk about Afro-pessimism and the false arc of a redemptive narrative and how that applies to your book?
Yes. Well, I read to begin with was again a small passage from Orlando Patterson's Slavery and Social Debt. And one of the things that that I think this notion that he's bringing up, that the violence that is gratuitous, in other words, gratuitous violence is a kind of structure, it's both structural and performative. It's a violence that has no coherent sense-making reasons for it. In other words, you can't say, gratuitous violence is triggered by so-called bad behavior by Indians, Native Americans, or Latinx people. It's not triggered by the oppressive paradigm's need to discipline people to produce, say, occupied land or to produce surplus value in capitalism. So if you live in a paradigm of contingent violence, then you can actually tell stories of redemption. I mean redemption in a rather abstract way. In other words, I mean moving from plenitude or equilibrium, plenitude slash equilibrium, which would be before 1492, if you're Native American, before contact, then moving to the arc of conflict in the narrative, which would be disequilibrium, the occupation by Europeans and the deracination and genocide, and then moving to equilibrium restored, plenitude restored, or reimagined, which is always there. If you look at Native American cinema, for example, if you look at working class cinema, if you look at the cinema and stories of say, post-colonial revolutionaries, the story doesn't have to end in real life with the regaining of liberation. But what it can do is it can end in a conceptual coherence of what liberation might look like. And the reason that can happen, and this is, I think, one of the most profound interventions of Afro-pessimism for people like Sadia Hartman, Jared Sexton, Zakiya Amon-Jackson, David Marriott, and there are many other people that I can name. The interesting thing about this is that if there was no moment of plenitude, in other words, if the word, which we would argue, if the word Black as noting a sentient being, and the word Africa as noting a cartography, are imbricated like bricks in the destruction of the African continent by the Arabs and the Europeans. In other words, if there are people before that, but they're not Black, they're Ashanti, they're Buganda, they're Maasai. In other words, this structural position is very much like the structural position of worker. There's no such thing as a worker 500 years ago. Worker comes into being with capitalism. And so if you have a situation in which this word Black is elaborated by this gratuitous violence, that's number one. Then what you don't have in that macro schematic narrative arc, you don't have a prior moment of whole living of plenitude for this word Black before social debt, before slavery. Is that making sense so far?
So far.
Okay. So what that means, then you come back to what I said, what Patterson said about the violence is necessary to create a paradigm. You can't have a paradigm, you can't have a stratified society with people coming together, collectively agreeing that there'll be some people on top and some people on the bottom, okay? You're going to need structural and performative violence to make that happen. But if we also say that that's the case of the worker, radical feminists would say that's the case of these two, what they would call artificial positions called man and woman. That's the case of the native and the settler in Edward Said's Orientalism. If that's the case, and you map onto that a paradigm where there is no prior liberatory moment for this position, and if the antagonist is not the worker, not the man, not the colonial dominator, but humanity itself, in other words, the argument is that humanity needs anti-Black violence to distinguish itself as itself from what it is not, then you're in something which disrupts that arc, because you can't imagine what was before. And if your antagonist is not a certain kind of economic system, is not a certain kind of kinship system, is not a certain kind of cartographic system like colonialism, but if your antagonist is the human race itself, then what you have is a situation in which A, it's constructed, that's the optimism, it can be dealt with, but B, you cannot write a sentence as to how to deal with it, because the past that was plenitude and equilibrium is always embedded in the end of other narratives in the denouement, which is called redemption. And so what we've done at a metacritical level is to blow the lid off of the concept of redemption by suggesting it is not any more universal than the word human, that it requires its other. In other words, it requires a sentient being walking around who can never be redeemed. And we think that that's the place that Blackness occupies in the libidinal economy, in the collective unconscious, especially in the collective unconscious of people who say, I don't see race. You know, I'm like Dr. King. I judge children on the character or the quality of their character, not the color of their skin. What that means is that they're not lying consciously, but they're not tapped into their unconscious, what we call in psychoanalysis, primary processes of signification. They're like most people, they're talking to you through secondary processes of signification, their conscious mind, and saying that's all there is to me. No, there's something more essential. There's something that Frantz Fanon calls Negro phobogenesis, which is a phobic response to Black bodies that actually does not have a conceptual grounding wire. You just, your unconscious just knows, I'm phobic. I have an eruption of anxiety to a Black body. But unlike my eruption of anxiety to Native Americans, or Fanon is debating Sartre in his book, my phobic anxiety to Jews, or my phobic anxiety to Latinx people, I can't say why I have that anxiety. I just know Black people make me uptight. And that is symptomatic of the very first thing I said before I started reading. It's symptomatic of the slave living in a structure of violence that cannot be reconciled with the structure of violence of other oppressed people, because his, her, or their structure of violence goes on with its gratuitous nature even after people have been conquered and acquiesced. It's a hang, because where you cannot actually say, why did the cops shoot me, if anti-Black violence is necessary to the psychic health of the world.
But if so, okay, argument understood. Now apply that to the end of your book, which seemed to have a redemptive quality to me, or did I misread it?
Oh, you know, I used to tell graduate students that.
Graduate student anymore. Those days are over. But I'll listen.
I would say that if in my first books, if you find the scintilla, you know, of redemption and hope in any of my work, please tell me so I can excise it.
It's too important to excise, though. Yeah.
And so I didn't do that this time, because I can see exactly, and I don't want to give it away. It has to do with my relationship with my mother, and I can see how the general reader could think that, wait a minute now, his first two books, especially his middle book, you know, he's saying, you know, what Sadia Hartman had said long ago, you cannot implot the slave in a narrative, because slaves are implements of other people's needs, even in the psychic imagination. You know, slaves are not agents of their own will and volition. They are implements. And this is what I think I argued very well with respect to cinema in my second book. So then you have this book that ends with what seems to be a denouement. And I'm mature enough now, having turned 64 about 20 days ago or something like that, that I can live with that. Because it's really not true. But to see how it's not true, you have to read a lot of Fred Moten, and you have to read critical theorist who was very instrumental in helping me get this book published, and who actually blurred the front of my book, and you have to read Fred Moten in conversation with Jared Sexton. So I get it that the average person who doesn't know what Afro-pessimism is, the average person who doesn't read psychoanalysis, the average person who doesn't read Marxist theory at all, and nor have they read the critique from the left by Afro-pessimism, they're going to think, oh, this is like a redemptive thing that he's all against. But in point of fact, what Sexton has done in his dialogues and my dialogues with Fred Moten also, but Sexton's have written them, you know, with Fred Moten, has said that there is social life, a kind of borrowed institutionality that looks like agency inside of social death. And what the end of the book does is it doesn't show you its seams. It doesn't actually say, here's what I'm doing. So there are a lot of people that aren't going to get it. But what it says is that at the end of the day, there's widespread political disagreement in an intramural way between Black people. So you've got my parents who are liberals and love the country. You've got me who's a radical communist and then becomes Afro-pessimist and hates the country. And they've been duking it out for 40 years. And it looks like there's some kind of rapprochement. And the rapprochement is important, and important because it does something to better the day-to-day experience of slaves on the plantation. The plantation I'm calling our big house in Minneapolis, Minnesota, okay?
The plantation. Are you talking about relations?
Yes. It does something to better the day-to-day intramural experience. But the rapprochement, we would argue, is completely inessential to the project of Black liberation from the paradigm of anti-Blackness. Because what the Indian in the book does is it recognizes that there are important political differences between these people that can never be reconciled. But they both have seemed they're not going to fight about this so much anymore. They both suffer the same hydraulics of anti-Black gratuitous violence, even though their attitudes towards the country cannot be reconciled. And I think that this is a good point, you know, that people doing race theory don't always get, but people doing Marxist theory can get it better. You know, in other words, Antonio Gramsci, the great communist theorist of hegemony, can write his 3,000-page prison notebooks and understand that the strikers in Turin in the first 20 years of the 20th century are mortal enemies to Mussolini's black shirts at the level of experience and at the level of day-to-day practice. But in the paradigm, they are both the hosts of a parasite called capitalism. It's just that the fascists are oppressed by capitalists. They're having surplus value sucked from their body, and they're the implements of capitalist domination. And the communist workers are oppressed by capitalism, and they're conscientized to rail against it. That's important, because it would be great, what Gramsci is suggesting, if the fascists could understand, whoa, Jack, we don't need to work for fiat. We don't need to be black shirts for fiat. We need to be part of the Communist Party to destroy Italian communism. It'd be great if that happened. But the point of the matter is that structurally, if it never happens, those two entities are the same in the paradigm of capitalism. And so the end of the book doesn't make the argument like a hammer blow, because in the end of the book, I'm really trying to speak to Black people about how we are with each other. And what I have to do that in this episode with my family is to forgo the apparatus of critical theory. But if the person is curious and has read Sexton and has read Moton, they'll get it. Aha, this is an episode of the social life in social death. This is people on a plantation, which we argue 21st century America is, saying that they're going to be kinder to each other.
Clearly, I need to read more Sexton and more Moton, because I got suckered in by the emotional aspects of it.
That's okay, it'll sell books.
So let me go to some of the audience questions. Do you think other scholars misunderstand and or oversimplify Afro-pessimism? If so, how?
Yes, 3,000%. In order to make the lighting cool for the visuals, it's hot for me in my study. So, but there's an article, and I forget where it's published, but you can. Many people in the audience have read it, called Jared Sexton wrote, called Afro-pessimism, the unclear word. Afro-pessimism, the unclear word. You know, you just Google it, you'll find it. And one of the things that he does in that article is, at the very beginning, one of the many things that he does is to show that the actual response to the Afro-pessimist assumptive logic an ensemble of claims is not, and he's talking about from professors and, you know, highly theoretical people. It's not an analytic response. It's an emotional response. And one of the ways he characterizes that these responses are redundant. They show that the people haven't actually read the key Afro-pessimist thinkers, or they don't understand the vernacular of critical theory, which is okay. Before I met Edward Said, I didn't really understand critical theory either, but it requires learning, and anyone can do it. I taught the works of Antonio Gramsci to young 18, 19, 20-year-old people in Soweto who had holes in their shoes and were going to the United Nations Food Bank to get grain after college, in a college I taught in Soweto, and then coming back to do workshops on this highly, highly sophisticated theory, which you had to know. You had to know Marxism, you had to know the theory of hegemony, and you had to know what Gramsci's nouns were that he used, like the word social formation meant class, because he wrote it for 10 years in prison, he had to get it past Mussolini's censors. So in other words, people, one of the problems is that people hear this, Black people aren't human. And instead of thinking, that's a very interesting claim, let me figure that out, they say, I am too human, you know? Because if they went into it, what they would see is that the Afro-pessimist gesture is a critique and condemnation of human capacity, the capacity to be human, because that capacity is parasitic on Blackness. Just like the capacity to have surplus value and be a capitalist is parasitic on the working class. And so it's an argument that shows what are the capacities, what are the constituent elements of humanness? In other words, it doesn't take it to be organic. And then where does that power come from? So people respond emotionally to the words, number one. Number two, a lot of people have staked their careers on the exact opposite, that we're all part of a universal human family. And if you've written three books like that, you're not gonna, and so what Sexton causes is, quote, the anxiety of antagonism. And this is the last point I'll make before I close on this question. Because the anxiety of antagonism is something that was very interesting to me as I travel the world. I have had to deal with the anxiety of antagonism in teaching young people in the United States in a way that I have not had to deal with it in Germany or in South Africa. And that is the anxiety of being presented with a problem for which there is no imaginable solution. Even though there is a solution, it cannot be theorized at this moment. And so the anxiety of antagonism produces responses which are redundant and unread and emotional rather than analytic. And that has a lot to do with the work of Matthew Arnold, who wrote in 1869, he changed the British public school system. And one of the things that he did, he said, we can't be teaching people in public schools problems that don't have solutions. Because if they do that, the working class will develop the solutions themselves in the streets and destroy capitalism, like they're doing in France. So when we present a problem in a classroom, we present it with a solution. And this has been the bane, the most besetting hobble of British and American psychic reality. This need to have policy-oriented questions for every problem there is. And it means that you're not a good thinker, and you certainly won't become a great revolutionary.
It reminds me of the part in the book where after seeing or being in proximity to the massacre in South Africa, you come up with an exercise for the class and everybody, an exercise about violence, and everybody don't want anything to deal with it. They don't want to think about it and how they're privileged and benefiting from the perpetration of that violence.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that, because I almost read that passage. I was between that passage and this one. But yes, that's precisely. And you know, this book ended up being 113,000 words. I think I turned it in to Bob at 150,000. He was like, your contract says, you know, then I tried to trick him and turn it in at 130,000. And he said, no, your contract says. And so he gave me an extra 3,000 words. But I, you know, there was that vignette that you're talking about where I'm teaching creative writing in the Extension School at University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. Those creative writers are all white, except for one guy from Soweto. And he was so happy to have this exercise. And I had to truncate. You know, I wrote the whole thing out in my journal, but I had to truncate it because when he saw the rage in these white students' response to me, he just tucked his shoulders in, and, you know, because he's a South African and he knew what could happen with that rage. You know, I'm a Black American and I don't give a damn, you know, and so you get buck with me, I'm gonna get buck with you, you know. But you know, you got to bring ass to get ass is what they say. You know, but that cat was in the corner, man. He was just like, oh God, where's this gonna go? You know, so yes. Anyway, your next question.
Yeah, somebody actually posted a link in the questions and answers to the Sexton article.
Okay, so, okay.
Cool for some of the listeners and viewers. Okay. There was a question, and I'm having trouble finding it now, about how to take the language of Afro-pessimism. How do we translate lay parlance practice amongst what slum dwellers, just sort of riffing off what we were just talking about?
Well, we don't.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that would be a dangerous move. You know, one of the things that I say at the end of a dangerous move, because rather than do it theoretically for the sake of a wider audience, let me do it anecdotally. You know, when I go places and I give, you know, big kind of lectures and readings in mainstream auditoriums or art museums in Vienna, Berlin, this kind of thing, I always ask the organizers to find me a group of Black people who are involved in the movement for Black lives, whether your city has a Black Lives Matter chapter, you know, or whatever. And so I end up doing a 3-hour workshop on Afro-pessimism, because before this book came out, and, you know, even for the past 10 years, what a lot of people don't know is that there's this subterranean river of people around the world, Black people in all these different cities, who are reading Afro-pessimism and debating and discussing it on Tumblr and social media. And while people in the academy have been lampooning it or poo-pooing it, whatever. So when I'm going to places like this, like a community center in Montreal, a Black community center, or a group of Black Lives Matter people in Vienna, I'm entering a space where these comrades, brothers and sisters, are involved in reformist political ventures. In other words, they're not making the Fanonian call for the end of the world, the call that comes from Afro-pessimism, the end of the human capacity to make world, which is a capacity that is parasitic on Blacks. They're just doing things like, we got to stop the police from killing us. We need better housing, you know, and that's right. You know, that's because Black people, especially now, we're seeing the structural violence, the anti-Blackness of structural violence from COVID-19, the way Black people are dropping like flies and nobody's shooting them. There's a structural dynamic to this, you know? And so I don't go in and say, y'all got these reformist goals, you know, and you need to, because they've invited me to do a workshop on Afro-pessimism. And so what the first thing I do is celebrate their efforts for a more or less civil rights agenda, because that has opened up a space which they have, you know, gladly invited me and others into, to talk more concretely and deeper about the structure of Black suffering, even though their political projects are not about the structure of Black suffering. They're about this immediate thing, like, can we get police accountability? Whereas Afro-pessimism calls for the end of the police. Two different things. But in point of fact, why then do these people in these movement for Black lives keep inviting Afro-pessimists to come in and do these closed door workshops? It's because Afro-pessimism is not a discovery. It's a big ear, a big listening ear to Black people at their best, to the kinds of articulations that Black people make and would make if they didn't have to make sense to the world. And so the space of reformist organizing has been a space that has opened up for a more comprehensive theoretical understanding of Black suffering. And so it's a two-way street. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the movement of Black Lives. And the movement of Black Lives is trying to widen its perspective. But I always go in with this thing, what we're doing here today is two trains running. You've got your train of what you need to do. You can't, you know, even though some of you might be revolutionary minded, you can't go to your Black community and say, you know, all right, now let's deal on the system with the end of the world. You know, you can't mobilize people overnight like that. But the beauty of it is that the space that they have has been open to thinking about the structure of suffering as opposed to the immediacy of the rituals. And so these two things work together, but you can't necessarily at this moment in history bring Afro-pessimism in and say, well, so here's the praxis, you know, the way that Che Guevara or Fidel Castro brought Marxism or Lenin brought Marxism in and said, so here's the praxis. We're not there yet.
Okay. Well, you had mentioned Fanon earlier, and here's a question that mentions Fanon as well. How, with your own experience of the South African struggle, would you explain the fact that South Africa has not been able to avoid the national pitfalls that Fanon so clearly explained half a century before the resolution of that struggle?
Andy, could you do something for me? Yes. Can you say what you think that question is asking? Because I could talk about South Africa all day long, and we'd be off on a tangent, and our time would be up. So,
right.
Help me out here. What is the nodal point?
How, with your own experience of South Africa, would you say that they have fallen into the trap, essentially, that Fanon laid out, was that they could get that they could possibly get through?
Yeah. So, say it again.
In an ideal resolution of the struggle.
I'm gonna do it really impressionistically, and I would say to this person to really read two things. My first book, Incognito, and you know half the book really deals with that question. So, and I'm just to be honest with you, this book is done and dusted. I'm heavily involved every day in marketing and talking with people like you on the phone and getting set up, you know. And when I have intellectual time, I'm writing a new novel for my next book. So I don't remember everything in Incognito, you know, about that. But what I will say is this. There was a moment in 1992 when we had an opportunity. We had an opportunity. There were committees that I was on, and we were studying Fanon. We were studying Fanon. Chris Haney, who was head of chief of staff of the arm wing, wanted the person who was my handler and people in that cell to write a book, The Wretch of the Earth, for South Africa, so that we could avoid what Fanon lays out in the chapter called The Pitfalls of National Consciousness. And he says, what you're gonna get is a middle class that just wants to get over, have good jobs, and have a connection to Europe, and you're gonna find yourself more impoverished than you were under colonialism, except for have a black face, and then all the problems that happen, the world will talk to you as though they're your problems. You know? And that's exactly what happened to South Africa. And there was a moment in which there were a group of us over here in the ANC writing documents about how we were going to de-link the political economy, not just of South Africa, but of the entire Southern African region, de-link political economy from global capitalism by producing a barter system between South Africa, Mozambique, South Africa, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Botswana, South Africa, Zambia, you know, the frontline states that had suffered 1.5 million deaths because they housed us during apartheid. We were going to create a system where the resources that we had would be bartered more or less with the resources that they have. And so we would not be exporting raw material to the West. We would renege on the IMF World Bank loans, and we would completely cut ourselves off. Okay, so in this period, you had the moderates, right, who weren't down with that. And their argument was that, look, if we do this, they're gonna vamp on us the way they vamped on Cuba. And the people that I was with were like, yeah, we'll bring it on. You know, I mean, it would be very interesting for the American military to send a battalion of soldiers and sailors, many of whom were black, to come fight against a black liberation movement. Let's see how that goes down. Because we know what happened to your ass in Vietnam, okay? Where more officers died with a bullet in their back. But, you know, so we were the so-called ultra-proclaimed brinksmanship. But in that period, to make a long story short, the moderates who had been in exile in the West were in deep conflict with the radicals who had been in exile in Cuba and in the Soviet bloc and in North Korea and in Palestine, and the radicals who had stayed in the countries. We were having a deep ideological conflict. What do we want to do? You know, and in this period, the Soviet Union crumbled. And what that meant was that the moderate faction of the ANC had more power and global connections than the radical faction, because $400 million from the non-communist West had flowed into the ANC over the past like 30 years in cash, and $400 million in weapons and logistical support and training had flowed into the ANC from the Soviet bloc. And so we were kind of like even at loggerheads, you know, because the people on the ground were down for a total revolution where we take back the land, we take back the banking, we take back the mining, and we give the middle finger to the West, you know. But when the Soviet Union fell, that ended the support of the radicals. And so one of the key moves, and I'll end it right here, in the negotiations called CODESA that began in late 91, Nelson Mandela very shrewdly took all of us communists off of the negotiating committee that was negotiating with the apartheid state for the future dispensation of the economy. And he put Thabo Mbeki, who was a London Economic School trained person that became the second president, he put him on the committee. And then he took the radicals and he put them on the kind of social cultural committees negotiation, you know? So what the moderates did, we had a mandate to nationalize the central bank, to tell the IMF and the World Bank that the loans that we owed to the Western world were loans that had been secured by the apartheid state, and we were simply going to renege on those loans, to nationalize the mines, and to take back all the corporate farms and redistribute the land. And once the moderates faction, once the Soviet Union fell, and then the West, in conjunction with some people in our own party, were able to assassinate Chris Hani and marginalize Winnie Mandela. And once they then commandeered all the negotiating committees on the economy, the fix was in. We were right back in Fanon's chapter in The Wretched of the Earth called The Pitfalls of National Consciousness. The comprador class, the middle class, the people who are affected, emotionally invested in a kind of Western-style non-communist democracy sold us down the river. And we're all part of the same party, so they did it legitimately. Then they purged 100,000 of us from the 350,000 ANC and turned it into the shit show we have now.
Oy. There's one question here. I probably have 10 more, and it looks like there are about 16 more on the screen in front of me. We don't have time, unfortunately, so I'm just going to pick one that I think might offer a good ending, and that is, I lost it. What are the emerging debates, questions, and Afro-pessimism that excite you?
Well, I'm really tickled and energized by the way in which Afro-pessimism has scandalized the very foundation of the humanities. In other words, I'm trying to do this without doing getting into Lacanian psychoanalytic speak and without getting into semiotic speak. But anyone who does post-structuralist critical theory understands that after May 1968, something major happened in which post-structuralism came into its own, you know, with the people in Paris from Derrida to Foucault to Lacan, Roland Barthes, you know, and Antonio Gramsci was resuscitated, began to be read. And so one of the major touchstones or foundations of humanities research, so much so that most graduate students don't even question it today, is that everyone is positioned in subjectivity in the same way. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that you're born You go 18 months as in French, the word would be as an enfant. And then you are inculcated or brought into a linguistic system. And when you're brought into a linguistic, slowly after 18 months brought into a linguistic system, you become positioned through discourse as a subject. So that for, and that, but that positioning is happening prior to your acquisition of speech. That position is happening prior to your birth. If an ultrasound is done and the ultrasound shows a penis, there's nothing there in reality, but discourse is mapped onto that pound of flesh in a gendered way. In other words, the room is painted blue when the parents go home after seeing the ultrasound. Boy, names like Andy and Frank are tossed about as opposed to Josephine and Bernadette. The father's dreaming of football or soccer, you know. The mother's wondering what kind of husband he might make it, you know, all the kind of, in a heteronormative word. So in other words, discourse, language, the semiotics of signs begin to create this being prior to its birth. And when it acquires language, it enters discursively into that. And one thing, whether you're Marx or Freud or Lacan, there's, you know, and all the theories built upon that, everyone is in agreement with this is how subjectivity works. And so one of the things that Afro-pessimism has done is said that there's a sentient being that is not positioned by discourse. That's a really scandalous and interesting thing. And we, you know, I would need 10 weeks of a grad seminar to explain how that goes. And we'd have to read a lot of psychoanalysis and Marxism first, but that's the end of the argument. There's a being that is not positioned by discourse in the essential way, but positioned by violence. And that makes that being irreconcilable with all the other beings, rich or poor, brown, yellow, red, white, incompatible. And so what it does is it comes back to scandalize the very foundation of humanistic research from literature to psychoanalysis to philosophy by saying there is no such thing as a universal subject, because the subject is a parasite of the Black, the slave. And so we have done very rigorous work to show how that works, whether you're reading the cultural history of Cynthia Hartman or the psychoanalytic topographies interventions of David Marriott, or the critiques of multiculturalism, mixed race, melded with psychoanalysis of Jared Sexton. And so what we're finding is that this hurts people. Yeah, it hurts me. I'm living with it, you know. And their response is highly emotive as opposed to highly theoretical. And so this is, in the next 10 years, you're going to see about 10 to 15 books from people who are grad students and assistant professors, which outline this, you know, another plot right here. You know, not just in this country, but here's an Afro-pessimist reading of life in Brazil, which is absolutely fascinating. You know, the lived experience of the Black person in Brazil is different than the lived experience of the Black person in the United States. But what Jaime Alves has been able to do is to show how the structural dynamic is the same. And so that I'm excited about the way in which this is going to upending the assumptive logic of the humanities. It's upending the assumptive logic of Black studies, and it's spreading to upend the assumptive logic of the social sciences as well.
It sounds like you all could be putting yourself out of a job.
You know, I told my client, I'd be out of a job if we had a string of presidents who were more like Trump, because my investigations and critiques of the libidinal economy through, you know, my second chapter of my second book, it's called The Narcissistic Slave, in which I take Lacanian psychoanalysis and I look at it schematically and I say, okay, so here's what makes sense about its description of the unconscious, but here's why the psychoanalytic cure is inadequate, you know? And I'm arguing that there's this kind of kernel of phobia of anti-Blackness that actually cannot be therapeutically dispensed with. So I'm actually arguing with Fanon, because Fanon runs up against this wall, you know? But you can only do that in a civil society that hides its hatred. You know, I could not do that. Once you're out of a job, I would have been out of a job like in 1800 to 1830 when Andrew Jackson was president, you know? Now that we've got Andrew Jackson again as president, a true American president who speaks the true unconscious of America. I mean, if he'd been president for the past 100 years, there'd be no reason for me to do rhetorical analysis of anything, you know, because the unconscious would be out there, out in the open, speaking the American dream the way it used to speak in the 19th century.
Well, Frank, it's been terrific talking to you, hearing you talk. The book is wonderful. I highly recommend it to people. And this is where I say thank you and good night, and encourage people to follow us on Crowdcast and visit us online at freelibrary.org/author-events to access our digital archives and updated event schedule. Thank you again, Frank. Everyone, keep reading and have a good night.
Thank you. Take care.